Hi, this is Catherine McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
On a Tuesday here on the West Coast. I'm not sure where Como is. I think on the East Coast.
No, I'm on the net.
I know you are, but are you on the East Coast or where the hell are you located?
Physical. I'm on the East Coast now, sir. Quantico,
Virginia. The crossroads of the Marine Corps. The or the off-ramp of the Marine Corps. It depends when you're there. So, Como, let's talk about you were on a week ago. And first of all, let me back up. All right, Scott, tell everybody who you are, what you do for a living, what you're doing now, and then let me set up where we're at, and then we'll go from there.
Okay, awesome, Matt. Thanks.
Yep.
For everyone listening, I am an infantry officer somewhere around 18, just under 18 years, MAGTOP planner guy, love being a Marine, addicted to being a Marine. And about whatever it was, 2 years ago, the Commandant created something called the Strategist Program, and I'm one of the two guinea pigs, if you will. So I am in the program, so I am technically a international relations / government PhD student at Georgetown, ideally for another about 17 months before we'll see what the gun club says I do next. Some have said I will likely have the privilege to go back to the infantry for a little bit. Some say I'm a nut and that won't happen. So we'll roll the dice and see what happens. But that's what I'm doing now. I'm trying to help with efforts like this and in various OPTs and force structure related things. Just trying to help as best you can, taking the education that the Commandant and obviously the taxpayer has afforded me the opportunity to have and just trying to help. So that's what I'm doing now.
Okay. And I think even, I said earlier in the program, but even the rubes among us, right, see the dwindling numbers of amphibs, and anybody who's been in the operating forces in the last 17 years knows that whenever you talk amphibious operations in any of the MEFs, one of the most challenging parts is finding amphibious platforms that can support because of their not only availability issues but their maintenance issues. And again, it's not lost on any of us that the amphib Navy is not a priority for the United States Navy. So I think I think even the rubes among us know that, and we look to the future and say, okay, we hang our hat on forced entry. That's been our bailiwick. And where does that go in the future? And I'm hearing this peer-to-peer discussion. I'm looking at the lethality of air-to-surface missiles. I'm looking at the lethality of surface-to-surface missiles and the ability to target things and the accuracy of those things, and thinking, how in God's name would you do that? So with all that looming on the horizon, the article that Scott et al., first of all, give us a little bit about everybody who's part of your team here that wrote this.
Okay, no, awesome. Thanks again, Mac. It's humbled to be able to work with them, just an incredible group of folks. So, let's start with the one in combat overseas right now. Captain Olivia Garrard is a former VMU pilot down in Yuma. She is a Princeton grad rugby player who decided, asked the gun club to delay going to OCS so that she could go to King's College London and get her master's in war studies before she ever became a second lieutenant. And then she's over with Task Force Southwest right now because she was not able to deploy while she was in VMU-1 for 3 years, because this goes to our previous conversation, or two conversations ago on All Marine Radio, about the platforms that VMU-1 had then. But so she is overseas with the team downrange, doing all they can to hunt down targets in Helmand. So that's, and then she's on loan from the Ellis Group. So she moved from VMU-1, and this is a good news story, Ellis director, General Alfred, General Wortman recognized her talents and brought her there. She's in charge of a variety of efforts. Some we probably shouldn't. Good stuff related to the article, but she's on loan over in Afghanistan to help there, and then she'll come back. So that's one of the co-authors. Second in command of VMU-1 right now is, we spoke about this last week, is Lieutenant Colonel Noah Spataro. He served last year as one of the SecNav's Innovation Fellows up in Monterey. So between Olivia and Noah, they are probably either the two top or two of the top experts on swarming autonomy, remotely piloted aircraft in the Marine Corps. Noah's doing great work, call sign Spool. Today, if listeners don't know, flying out of Yuma, we are almost at 3,000 hours of MQ-9s being controlled from Arizona, supporting our, I don't know if we can say the number here, but our Marines and Hellman with all sorts of strikes on a daily basis. And then the fourth co-author is a superstar named Major Jeff Cummings, who's a FAC out of EWS now. Prior to doing that, he was 2/8 OPSO out on the B-Surf mission out in Europe, and then he had previous as a company commander. He was out in Indo-PACOM, and then he was he's done a bunch of MUs in Iraq and whatnot. So a dynamic team. He's an infantry guy, obviously. And then two, Spool is a UAS pilot and an airspace ninja, but really, really great, and they've helped me a bunch. Does that answer that, Mac?
Yeah. The article is broken up into actually it says six, but for our purposes in five sections. Part one, opportunity leveling context and background. We talked about that last week. Part two, amphibious paradigm, that no longer solves the right problem. Three, new USMC big idea theory based on the 2018 National Defense Strategy intent and global operating model. Four, new USMC big idea in practice. Five, top eight actions required to implement the big idea. So we got kind of most of the way through part three. But what I'd ask you to do now is, can you, take about 10 minutes or so and summarize parts one, two, and three, wave top stuff, and then we'll start on part, we'll finish up with part three and go to four and five.
Okay, I will do my best. All right, so the overall effort with the article, we had written, the co-author team had written five articles for War in Iraq, and Colonel Woodbridge, the Gazette editor, obviously superstar, asked, hey guys, can you synthesize these five into one piece for our senior leaders and obviously for fellow Marines and anyone else that's reading the Gazette? So that's what this is, and so we broke it down in the part one leveling opportunity. Is kind of the foundation. Why are we here? How did we get here? And some of this was based on the National Defense Strategy. Some of it was based on the National Defense Authorization Act last year. Both the Senate version, some determined and read it. There was an article in Breaking Defense titled Wither the Marines, tied to the Marine Corps continues to say that what it does is 2MAB joint forcible entry, amphibious assault, and for all the reasons, Mac, you just walked through, how – the logic flow doesn't jive. So there was a lot of pressure, most importantly from Congress and certainly from a variety of think tanks. So the foundation was saying, you know, we all know 74 years in Iwo Jima, a couple of days. We all know what our forefathers and perhaps some listening did at Iwo Jima and their incredible heroism. And then at the time, Secretary Forrestal was saying, gun club exists for 500 more years. Well, 70 years later, there is immense pressure on our service in the Beltway from think tanks and Congress saying, Marine Corps better figure out something new to do, or it faces, or it risks extinction. So the orientation or the foundation is that, you know, those are facts. We may not like them or we may not want to hear them. That's the case. We have done one amphibious, large scale amphibious assault in the last 69 years. One in Incheon against a threat that did not have persistent sensor networks, that didn't have ballistic missiles, that didn't have nuclear weapons, that today North Korea has 150,000 Chinese troops within 60 miles of all of North Korea's main or most of North Korea's nuclear and missile sites. So basically what that means is by the time that we would mobilize, it's a 60-mile walk to get to those sites. So we walked through, so that kind of started the foundation, and we walked through, okay, let's stop for a sec. The national security strategy that was published now a year and a half or so ago laid out what our primary competitor, and I'll read it. It says China and Russia want to shape a world antithetical to U.S. values and interests, and China seeks to displace the United States in the Indo-Pacific region, expand the reaches of its state-driven economic model, and reorder the region in its favor, and essentially transport its 1984-esque state-controlling totalitarian that we want nothing to do with. It's 180 out from who we are. And so that's kind of part of the foundation. Mac, you mentioned the missiles. You mentioned the persistent sensors. And then what has China in particular, and to a lesser degree, but one could argue the same degree, with Russia, what have they done in the South China Sea with China, and then you could say with Russia and the Crimea or whatnot. But because we're a maritime nation, we're a maritime force, we're a naval force, we're part of the Department of the Navy, it's what has China done primarily in the South China Sea and the Strait of Malacca. And if you look at those areas and you look at our allies and partners, not too thrilled with Marine Corps or United States reassurance, reliability, and kind of let's just level set and say that these are facts. We may not like any of them, but they're facts. And so that's the intro of the leveling foundation. And then it's how did, and actually one more piece of that, there's an image in the presentation, but most of the readers probably have an image. And if you don't, I would encourage looking at, say, the Spratly Island chain and going to the Center for Strategic and International Studies and looking at, they have the Asia Maritime Initiative, and it shows all the islands that the Chinese have built and then what they've done with them. You can see the radar sites, the missile sites, da-da-da-da, down the line over the last 10 years, 7 years in some cases, last couple of years. And when you look at them, what the article, we're kind of getting at in the intro, if you were the president, take uniforms off, take all the emotions off. If you were the president of the United States and you wanted to do something about that to get rid of those threats, would launching 30,000, 40,000 Marines be on the menu list? Would it be to logistically get them in there to provide all the air defense capabilities that Matthew mentioned? Or are there other ways, and then once they got there, to sustain them, to reinforce them, et cetera? Or are there other options to do this? Which challenge, and you know, hopefully one of the themes over the next hour and a half or so, we can get at what do words like joint forcible entry or forcible entry mean in 2019 and beyond? What is a phrase like power projection mean? So that's the intro. But before doing that, because we're such at the part two, the no longer solving the right problem, because we celebrate our birthday every year, you know, General Azure, and we read what he said, and we're such a prideful, justifiably, organization, just incredibly proud of probably what many people listening right now, what you did and what your peers did, and we want to know about them, and we want to take pride in them, and we want to live up to that legacy. It's a how did we get here? And so the second part of this is laying out what guys like Pete Ellis and General Ajern and the folks at MC, what is now Marine Corps University, but back in the 20s and 30s, we have the Corps that we have today, and it's largely anchored on the core that they created for us in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, because it was solving a problem of the Japanese Empire kicking us out of the Western Pacific, especially after the Philippines. And so they designed a force to then enable us to defeat the Japanese and then get American air power to get strikes on Japan. And so that's the force we have. Primarily, forcible entry means coming from California or coming from North Carolina. And some listeners might say, well, hold on, Scott. We do MUs and we do SP MAGTAFs, and all of those are true statements. But when you come back to how requirements are written, how manpower models are structured, how we think about the number of things that we need to buy and what we need to buy, it is all prioritized. The big idea currently is prioritized based on what Pete Ellis created and General Ajern created, and that's the second part of this. Yet, we live now in a world with nuclear weapons. We live now in a world with space being in the article mentions, you know, just simple things like the company, civilian company Planet Labs takes, this is a stat from a year ago, so it's probably more than that now, 1.4 million images of the Earth every single day and sends them down to a variety of sources. You can buy them on the internet. So what's the so what of that? what is the probability of the Marine Corps being able to mount up multiple large organizations on amphibious ships from San Diego or from Morehead City and sailing them thousands of miles and maintaining the element of surprise? The probability of that is almost zero. And we comment in the article, we talk about the Bin Laden raid being live tweeted before the first SEAL touched the ground in Ottobad. That was on Twitter. Before the president arrived in Iraq over Christmas time, 3 hours before, it was already on Twitter that he was going to Iraq, despite the fact that obviously all these missions were classified. So the second part talks about how we got to where we are, how we still say this is what we do, yet the character of warfare around us has changed. And for those listening, there are probably some on the net. And, Mac, I was looking back, and if I got this right, when former Commandant General Conway was a major, I think in 92 or 90, sometime around that time frame, or 91, he wrote a paper in the 92 time frame calling for enhanced company operations being the Corps' future. And then we had a concept document emphasizing that in 2000, I think it was 6 or 7. But we never did anything to actually come up with training requirements, prioritizing the people, changing our training construct, changing our evaluation construct, because it all goes back to the primary force design. And so basically in the latter part of that section, we lay out a picture of Incheon in 1950 and then of Cobra Gold last year. And if you look at it, they're very similar. There are amphibs coming, they landing vehicles, you know, amphibious landing vehicles coming from ships from close in range. And then we say, regardless of what and how much has changed in the international security environment, the Marine Corps still holds steady to the belief that our force design must be married to multi-MEB, large-scale joint forceable entry. And that framework is constraining the necessary conceptual and organizational adaption required to honor the threats that our nation currently faces. And as a result of that, you have Marines on the Hill who back in the late 40s and early 50s were our biggest allies. You have Marines on the Hill that want, and they still are. I mean, don't get me wrong, they're Marines at heart. Right. But they're asking things like, hey, what's the new story about the future? I got it. You want ships, but, you know, I'm reading verbatim. What's the new story about what the future fleet will do and how will it differ from today's fleet? And we must stop being always on the wrong side of the cost curve at every step. That's one congressman in the House Armed Services Committee now. Right. So that's, you know, through part two and then part three.
Just a footnote to that, Scott. That member has a military background, right?
So that member who said that is a Marine intelligence officer.
Thank you.
And I didn't serve with him, I've gotten to know him since. But these are guys with hearts of gold, and they there's other members that I did serve that I was in, you know, 1-4 with. I mean, at least as best I can tell, there are no Marines on the Hill saying, I want the Marine Corps in no way, shape, or form. I want it. There are Marines on the Hill saying, hey guys, we got to adapt. Like, there are real problems right now, and there's huge opportunities for a Marine Corps to do some slightly different things.
Right.
So let's do them. Let's work together. And so that intelligence, I mean, you can go to House Armed Service, and I can email him when we get off, and I don't know how you share him, but he asked questions in HASC hearings, like, have we really thought about the threats? I got it. You guys do forcible entry. Have you really, 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 really thought about the threats that are coming at you? And even if we gave you all the ships, say we get to the 38 amphibs in 2033. So right now the service says we need 38 amphibious ships to do what we need to do. And that's the quote unquote agreed upon number. And if you look at the projections in the shipbuilding plan, we are due to get them in 2033. So 14 years from now. And so a guy like this particular congressman would say, even if I gave you 38 ships tomorrow, can you do what the NDS requires you to do?
Yeah, does that still get you high on the menu of selected forces to go deal with this issue?
Right, and the answer to that, unfortunately, is no. And we know that. I mean, I don't know. The senior leaders, they know that. And we're struggling as a collective team to say, how do you leverage the changing? You know, I was going back and reading from our last talk. I was reading some of the stuff from when General Gray helped transform the Corps, obviously, probably with folks that are listening right now. Those were the technologies. I mean, we're all human. MCDP-1, FMFM-1, you know, fast transients. But there were still technologies that he recognized at the time that were going to help us do that better. So what we're struggling with right now is how do you change the organization with those new technologies given the threats? And I think that that's recognized that 38 is not going to do it, but the service doesn't know exactly yet. And I don't know that anyone ever is going to know exactly. We're not comfortable with the 70% violent. Like, we haven't – that hasn't been synthesized in our head. What is a 70% solution violently executed now so we can advertise it? So does that help, Mac?
Yes. Yes. All right, let's talk about – so when we got into part three and the new big idea, all right, so talk about the new big idea.
Okay, so
– and so what I'll tell you is we got about 67 minutes to cover what we didn't cover last week relative to part three, and then part four, the new idea in practice, and then part five, the top eight actions. So go. You have 67 minutes.
Okay. No. Good. So for listeners, the overarching, what I glean, for whatever the hell that's worth, you know, from meathead me, football player from New York, the number one problem to our country right now is China wants us out of the Western Pacific, period. Period, 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 period. There are problems all over the world. Clearly, the number one problem is over the last, since 92, and there's the graphics in the articles, China's economic growth has been unprecedented. China has bought 2,000-plus missiles. They want our asses out of the Western Pacific. They are bullying, coercing our allies in the Western Pacific. They are trying, for example, with Taiwan, they're trying to get countries to not recognize Taipei any longer. They're trying to break up our alliance network with the Philippines. This is our number one problem. The amount of times I have conversation with Marines and they say, Scott, we're a global organization. We have global responsibilities. I don't dispute that at all. But if you open up MCDP-1, it'll tell you got to figure out what the main effort is. And the number one problem that our country has today is you have a country that has 65% of the economic strength that we have. And as we covered last time, but if listeners didn't have the chance to chime in last time, over the last century, our country has not gone against a rival ever that had more than 40% of the gross domestic product of our own. Today, China is at 65%. The trajectory has it exceeding ours. And if you measure it in other ways, it's bigger than ours. If you measure it in purchasing power parity, their economy is larger than ours. Granted, their population is bigger, per capita it's smaller, but when it comes to the resources that they can allocate to generating war-making capability, we have never faced a threat like this in the last century. So when you go through this kind of the third section of this paper and what is the NDS trying to do, it's making sure, for example, that the article title, which we spoke about last time, and then our visualization of expanding the competitive space. So if we think about, I suspect, Mac, you'll laugh, and other people, if you think about a bullying incident in high school or elementary school, and maybe I shouldn't talk as frank as I'm going to talk, but whatever, this is, again, I'm from New York. So if you think about, you were the good guy, you're a Marine, you're a leader, you're 16 years old, 15 years old, and you're just going about your business, just being a good dude or dudette, whatever it is.
Yeah, I'm like the girl. I'm like the girl in the commercial.
Right. Right, right, yeah, no, good. That's you, and some asshole shows up and picks on a little kid. And you say, you're kind of minding your business, you're going to class, you're doing whatever you're doing.
Right.
And you catch it out of your peripheral vision, and you say, well, that's wrong. What the hell is happening right now? And you roll up and say, hey, mother.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, you get what I'm saying. You're out of your goddamn mind. Turn your ass around, not happening. And the bully looks at, this is none of your business. Get out of here. It's me versus him. No. What you're doing is wrong. Get your ass out of here, or I'm going to kick your ass. And that, you know, in most cases, the bully turns around and walks away. If you think about that type of dialogue and the expression in the National Defense Strategy of expand the competitive space today in the South China Sea, in the East China Sea, China is bullying our friends that our forefathers fought so hard to get us into these alliances or to get us this territory to expand democratic values, our economy, so on and so forth. So this part of the article, and when it's explaining the NDS, it's we've got to mentally think through what does that mean? What does bullying from an expanding, and we'll say, we'll call it coercion, and they're doing it through loans, or they're doing it through the Chinese maritime militia that, interestingly enough, you know, says Chinese Coast Guard in English. Why would they do that, not have it in Chinese? But this part of the article and in his presentation that we spoke through, it explains there's four overarching things that the National Defense Strategy is trying to do. It's trying to expand the mentally, the DOD, expand the competitive space of how you visualize warfighting and what the DOD does. We need to take our number one comparative advantage in these great power competitions, our allies and partners. We need to strengthen that. We need to consolidate it. We need to make them. I'm closing my fist right now. Like, if it's tight right now, our partnership with Japan is tight right now. Our partnership with Australia is tight. They need to be tighter. And as much as China's been able over the last 10-ish years to bully, say, a country like the Philippines, and the fist isn't that tight, we need to do whatever the hell we can to get it tighter.
And look, can I make a point? When you if you've paid attention to this thing that's gone on in that region, since President Trump has taken office, and we've increased not only our rhetoric, but we've increased the number of Freedom of Navigation Acts. I mean, the Chinese are trying to get us to stop driving between Taiwan and mainland China. That is a huge body of water that they say that's now off limits to everybody. And we quite rightly, and now increasingly with more of our allies with us, are saying we're not having that. And interestingly enough, the Philippines in the last, I think I saw the report within the last 30 days, are beginning to develop an atoll in the South China Sea. So they're beginning to push back. And just within the last week, I've read that Indonesia is beginning to push back against the Chinese claims and their bullying relative to their 9-dash line, which has to do with resources. So I think giving testament to what Scott's saying and the American position is this. If we stand up on our hind legs, which we've done in the last 24 months, I think our allies will begin to say, you know, right is right, right? And just because you point to the floor and say that direction is now up, it doesn't make it that way. And that is what the Chinese attempt to do. And so it's what he's talking about is happening, and I think there's positive indications. The question is, will the United States continue to maintain the course politically, which is a different question. Scott's talking about the assets, right, needed to make that strategy real.
Bingo. So and this goes to, and we'll probably, you know, go between parts 3 and 4 and 5 and go together. So you're, Mac, 100% right. And if you look at what the Philippines has done, some of this is because of what the administration has said. Some of this is because of Freedom of Navigation Act exercises. Some of it's because probably doesn't hurt when Vice President Pence flies over the Spratly chain in, you know, in America and says, we're here and this is international airspace and you're not going to. That clearly wasn't happening 3 or 4 years ago. And the question is to the last point that you make, as it relates to expanding the competitive space and allies and partners, do we decide as a DOD that this is a priority mission and figure out how to enable, because those freedom, there was a National Interest article yesterday talking about what's called FONOPS, these Freedom of Navigation exercise. They're good, but if for anyone listening that served in Afghanistan or Iraq, to some degree, they're equated to imagine a patrol going into Sokolowia or Fallujah or Marja or wherever. You're not there every day.
Sokolowia is a straight-up shithole, right?
So imagine you go there and you say, you get in contact, God forbid a Marine gets wounded, whatever the case is, and you come back, you know, you're good Marines, you fill out your after action, you know, you get it to the two, And, you know, commander gets pissed off and says, mother, we need to go back there tomorrow and da-da-da-da-da. And you go back in and you talk to whomever the elder is or is not or the police or whomever. And you go there and they say, what's great, happy you're here. But the moment you turn around and leave, whatever the enemy force was is here. And they're here at night. And they put a night letter and they knocked on my door and they threatened this and they threatened my kids. And so the FONOP, like the Marine Corps needs to be real quick. Like people want to run away from counterinsurgency. I think a lot of the things that we learned and we mention a maritime counterinsurgency in the article. There's a lot of lessons learned that we said, whoa, hold on. We need to distribute. We need to be across State Department. We need to have access to instantaneous fires. So it's the same thing here. If I do a FONOP with a destroyer and I drive through the South China Sea by pick your island, and the Chinese say, U.S. destroyer umpty frats, get your ass out of our space, and we leave, which we do after the end of these FONOPs because we don't have the capacity to stay there, the message that's being sent to our allies and partners are the Chinese told the Americans to leave. Cool for America. We get excited. It comes on CNN or Fox News. We act like we flexed our muscles. It's better than, you know, some of the quote-unquote scholars from the Beltway at all the think tanks and whatnot would say it's better in some respects to not doing it at all, but it's not enough.
Right.
And so this is part of, if we embrace expanding
as we learned in Iraq, right?
I mean,
that is faking it, right? And the Iraqis in those cities would ask us, are you going to stay this time? Because see that house there that's empty? Those people helped you the last time you were here. They were all murdered, and their bodies were left in that house, and we were told not to touch them, or they would come for us. So if we can't help you if you don't stay, and that's a huge issue.
So this, Mac, I mean, that for listeners, in our mind, our co-author team's mind, from a maritime threatened from the maritime region, the global commons, and when you look through the South China Sea and the Strait of Malacca, $1.2 trillion of the U.S. economy goes through there every single year. Since 1783, Michael Green, where is it? I'm looking at it. Michael Green wrote a book by More Than Providence, Grand Strategy and American Power in the Asia Pacific since 1783. While our foreign policy has ebbed and flowed, you can draw a straight line from 1783, and the American people have determined all the way back since then that there will not be a regional hegemon in the Western Pacific that is not the United States, because of all of our interests there. And so when we think through what you just said, if we do a FONOP and we're not there and China can return to being the bully again, we are certainly nowhere near as effective as we need to be. And furthermore, it might be, to the example that you just gave, it might be far worse. Maybe perhaps it hasn't gotten there yet, but maybe an ally says something and then we leave and the ally, you know, something worse happens to it. So this part of the section, it's talking about four kind of overarching strategic approaches as a national defense strategy. One being expanding the competitive space, two being strengthening our alliance and partners, three being greater performance and affordability. And as this goes to what we were just talking about with that example, if the only options that you have to do a FONOP are a $15 billion aircraft carrier, a $3 billion aircraft carrier, light carrier, whatever we want to call the America-class ship, a $1.6 billion amphibious ship that doesn't have all the defense systems that you need on it, or a billion-plus dollar destroyer, in limited capacity, you don't have the ability to do the previous two things that we spoke about persistently. And so how do you figure out, using the changing technologies that exist today, to be more affordable and have better performance? And then the fourth one goes to Secretary Mattis's Close Combat Task Force, build a more lethal force overall. So that's overarching what the NDS is trying to do, and that's, you know, we'll hit on those four themes. And this is because we got to expand the competitive space. Think about it differently. If you weren't listening last time, for any number of reasons, not saying that but to be a jerk, if you couldn't listen.
Well, no, hold on. Let me stop you. If you're listening to this one first, right, right? Don't be afraid to hit pause. Go listen to part one, which is a week ago. You'll see it, and it's labeled part one. Listen to that, and then come back to this, okay? Because I will tell you, it will help your understanding. It will progressively deepen and broaden your understanding if you listen to these sequentially. But with that caveat said, continue, Como.
Got it, sir. All right. So I'm going to talk about the NDS global operating model. Uh-huh. So it's got a contact layer, a blunt layer, a surge layer, and a homeland layer. And ironically enough, I saw the Marine colonel, infantry guy, think the world of, works on the joint staff this weekend, and we were talking through it. And the conversation says, so if you're listening and you're like, this NDS contact, blunt, surge, this is stupid. I don't like it. It doesn't make sense. What? The overarching point here is that conceptually it makes sense. So the contact layer is defined activities conducted in contested zones below what we would think of as armed conflict to expose malign behavior and counter adversary influence. Blunt layer is combat credible and warfighting oriented forces present forward to deter aggression or to degrade and deny adversary objectives in the conflict. Those are the areas where the Marine Corps has been asked to focus. You can read about our leaders saying this up on the Hill. And so if you hate contact layer, call it have Marines persistently forward in Sacagawea or Ramadi so that some asshole can't come in and threaten the family that you talked to. If you don't like contact layer, right, think about it that way. If blunt layer is you're in one of those regions and you have a small – you sent a squad out and – the squad gets overwhelmed by a adversary, you know, whatever, 20 dudes that are in a – have a force ready, combat credible, to go kick its ass immediately. Not, hey, I got to deploy from the United States. Not, it needs to come from six towns over immediately, as fast as you can, from, you know, time zero to now. And so the global operating model, we explain it in the article, and we think it's critically important because of – all that for the Marine Corps big idea going forward to grasp it because of the larger forcible entry construct that the Corps has. If you say that Planet Labs can take all these images and the Chinese have all these UAVs and the Russians have all these UAVs and the world of Internet of Things, you're not going to move a big force in a timely manner, and it can be targeted much earlier and much further. So let's get our asses in the contact layer and in the blunt layer, meaning let's be as far forward, as spread out as possible, as lethal as possible, and be able to rapidly reinforce those units. That's the new, you know, in a nutshell, the Marine Corps part of the national strategy is figuring out how to do that, not train big forces in the desert in California. And if a crisis develops, deploy big forces from California or Morehead City over 2 months. 2 months too late. 30 days too late. 15 days too late. Figure out how to do it within, you know, really from time zero as fast as you can. So
hold on. So we're not talking about pivoting towards the Pacific, right? We're talking about living in the Pacific.
Yes. In we need to look, and what I've encouraged, and some look at me like I'm nuts, and that's okay. I think it's great that we have discussions on all this. So in the article, there is a figure eight shows it's, I think it's a New Year's Eve snapshot of our carrier strike groups and our MU, ARG MUs in the world. And it shows a screenshot of it. And if you look in the South China Sea and in the Strait of Malacca, they're in a single amphib or carrier strike group asset there. Now, there may have been because it says this is only the capital assets. But the point being, you can look at this on a daily basis, and there's rarely a persistent presence that is reliable, that our allies know they're there, that our partners know they're there, that is nested into all elements of national power. What do we mean by that? That's nested into our intel assets, to what goes on at Fort Meade, to long-range strike capabilities that we've figured out the C2 there. And then the other graphic is laying out figure six that lays out China's import and transit routes. And if you look at that, and you say, okay, from a strategist or a planner perspective, and you say, what are the types of things that an adversary would try to do to us? And what are the things that they need to function? You know, the amateurs talk tactics, pros talk logistics.
Right.
If I look at this figure six, it tells me that China needs 9 million barrels of oil, 82% of their total daily requirement to go through the Strait of Malacca on a daily basis. That's an important data point. And then some have said to that, so I'll say it again, on a daily basis, our primary great power competitor needs 9 million barrels of oil to go through a fairly small choke point in the Strait of Malacca, or that is the Strait of Malacca. And some people will say, hey, but they're doing this Belt and Road Initiative thing to offset that dependence. And that's kind of a, I mean, yes, it's a true statement when you unpack what they're doing, but there's some important, I'm going to read something from Michael Beckley's Unrivaled that just came out. So the book's titled Unrivaled, Why America Will Remain the World's Sole Superpower.
Okay,
a little
now,
bit.
Hold on. Here's a little, just a programming note. I want you to read this thing from Beckley. I've got to take about a 2 minute break and then we'll keep going. Also, another footnote is, you sent me an article, Small Unmanned Aerial Systems and Tactical Control. If you want to footnote that, Scott, you can. It's going to be a link to the article is going to be included in this post. So when you're listening to this, if you click on the post itself, you'll see a link to this article that Scott sent me a little bit ago. So continue, my friend.
Okay, perfect. So I'm reading from page 116. If for whatever reason, guys got the book, and yes, I'm a dork. I'm in this program, so I'm not playing one up like my IOC instructors who brought in 14,000 books and told us to read them all and then go to the field and beat each other up for the next whatever. So I'm smiling a little bit. All right. So it says, with respect to transport infrastructure, countries with natural transport infrastructure, namely navigable rivers and deep water harbors, enjoy an economic advantage over landlocked countries because moving goods over land is 40 to 70 times more expensive than over water. Because moving goods over land is 40 to 70 times more expensive than over water. And then it lists the U.S. and it gives the comparative numbers. And when you look at figure six in the article, when you look at the Belt and Road Initiatives, and you say, if I needed 9 million barrels of oil, and China, for example, is building a road and rail infrastructure, if all works out well, from southwest Pakistan through the Hindu Kush region to get into western China, and many of you listening have probably been in those parts of the world, and you were to say, if you were to pick a single spot on the planet, say, I want to pick the hardest piece of terrain, the hardest stretch of terrain in the whole world, to build a road, to build a rail line, and make sure it works all the time and to maintain it, where would it be? And you'd probably say, let's try and do this in the Hindu Kush. So if it costs $2.40, if that 40 to 70 times is more on American highways, you can imagine the cost differential of moving, just as one example, 9 million barrels of oil through the Strait of Malacca via ship versus moving it on land. And there are other places that they're trying to do it, but the point is, these are not easy ways to do that. So if we think about that and say, wait a sec, this littoral choke point, Robert Kaplan describes as the 21st century folded gap. So from a big idea perspective, this is maritime, it is littoral. Something like the Marine Corps being able to influence this thing from a policymaker's 24/7, 365 probably moves towards sounding like a really good idea when it comes to enabling policy decisions, so on and so forth. So I'll stop right there, Matt, because I think you need to take a two-minute break. Is that accurate?
You're right. And let me just offer this up. If in the year 2019 the oldest civilization or one of the oldest civilizations on the planet hasn't built a road through a certain region, there's a reason for that.
Bingo.
There's reason for that. They've been around for a while. If it was easy, look, they built the Great Wall of China, for God's sake. Okay, if they could do that, they could undertake most endeavors. They have chosen forever not to undertake this. Probably a good reason for that. Which means, in terms of interdicting it, not that difficult. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back. My guest, Lieutenant Colonel Scott Cuomo, United States Marine Corps. He's speaking not only for himself, but a whole series of other officers that have contributed to this. We're happy to have him. We're talking future of the Marine Corps, which I will tell you this. I got off and I wrote in the post that I put up last week. For the first time in years, after reading this article, I believe the future of the Marine Corps is bright. And so, and I do. When you listen to this, it gets to all the things we know about future warfare. It puts the Marine Corps in a position to be, I would tell you, the go-to asset, right, in conjunction with the United States Navy. And again, I would tell you that in terms of prioritizing our peer competition, Russia's faking it. And Scott and I talked about their GDP last week. Even this story that's out today about, you know, a Russian TV station unveiled a list of targets. That is all Vladimir Putin propaganda. He's faking it, right? And he has to fake it because he doesn't have the GDP to compete, especially when you talk about hard currency. So he needs information operations. They're huge to what the Russians do. The real foe is China. The course of way that they use their economy and the way they continue to develop their military is something. And the world does not need, you know, an America that's eclipsed by the Chinese. It's for those of us that have been around the world and see all the great things that happen around the world, but that free countries do, the world does not need United States eclipsed by China. So, interesting conversation. We'll take about a two-minute break. More of All Marine Radio coming up next, right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of the 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when the group can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nelson. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Comer, you're lucky because I sing the living shit out of this song right here, but I'm not going to do that for you because we have bigger things to do. So maybe someday on a future visit, you can hear me do my Toby Keith impersonation. So I will spare you that today. My guest is Lieutenant Colonel Scott Comer, United States Marine Corps, and we're talking about the future of the Marine Corps. The article in its full length, which, as Scott has said, it's a combination of a number of efforts, but it's called Not Yet Openly at War, but Still Mostly at Peace, Exploit the Opportunity, underline, to Become the 21st Century Force that Our Nation Needs. Lieutenant Colonel Scott Comer, Captain Olivia, is it Gerard?
Gerard, sir. Or Matt.
All right. The Major Jeff Cummings, Lieutenant Colonel Noah Spatero. And underneath that it said, in the midst of every crisis lies a great opportunity. And that's a quote from Albert Einstein. So we're talking about the last three parts and of the article, and that is the new USMC big idea theory based on the 2018 National Defense Strategy intent and global operating model. And part four, the new USMC big idea in practice. Part five, top eight actions required to implement the big idea. So I want to know about the new USMC big idea in practice. How does it work?
Okay, so let's see. I'll read it and then talk through a graphic. So we believe, and we wrote this in the article, the foundation of this new big idea, and we use big, I mean, the foundation of what we do, our reason for existence, is not TUMEB, large-scale defeat. It is the following. Anchor on dominating the time domain by employing highly maneuverable, forward-partnered, persistent amphibious close combat units that operate throughout the contact layer's key maritime terrain with a Clausewitzian fancy word, attack defense mindset. So we'll unpack that for a sec. So distributing throughout key maritime terrain. So this would require the service to say, these are areas that matter. The bullies in the South China Sea. The South China Sea is big. These are the specific areas that they're bullying in, or we think they're going to. This is where they're in the Strait of Malacca. We pick the most important terrain, just like we would in any map in any attack, and then we say we are going to persistently have highly maneuverable amphibious close combat units. Last time we spoke about why we didn't call these amphibious MAGTAFs, amphibious infantry units, and this goes to Mac, the article that I sent this morning. When you put 30, 40, 50, 60, 70 Marines with a small number of sailors and create a package of 200 total in small amphibious, smaller amphibious ships, guys can get on and off of, on land. This is what we're talking. And they've got swarming kit, and they're there every single day with our allies, lockstep. And they're ready, if need be, to attack. And they've got a whole bunch of advantages. And this goes to the next slide, because some have criticized us and said, wait a sec, guys, your big idea is distributing smaller units. They're going to get overwhelmed in a heartbeat. That's been one of the criticisms, which, if anyone's listening, we are all about taking, you know, criticism and, you know, refining the idea. And
yeah, but hold on. So we can't overwhelm them, but they can overwhelm us?
Right. So, yes. So when you, I'm with you. And so there's a great book. Ian Easton's the author. It's titled The Chinese Invasion Threat, Taiwan's Defense and American Strategy in Asia. And it just gets at exactly, Matt, the tone of what you just said. And it lays out things like, we like to take PowerPoint slides to justify our force structure and every service's reason. And we say, look, China's in Taiwan. And literally the arrow on the PowerPoint slide made it happen. And Ian says, well, stop. In 1944-45, when we were contemplating getting on the east side of Formosa, we needed somewhere just under 500,000 troops was the estimate. Weapons at the time, you can imagine what the ranges of the weapons were at the time, nowhere near what they are today. No sensor networks, anything like they are today. And he lays out, if you're coming from west to east, there are 2 months of the year where the sea states kind of allow you to do an amphibious assault. And one of those months, it's overcast, so you really can't see. And then he goes into the dynamics of the terrain on Taiwan. But it gets to your point. Wait a sec. These guys can magically move 500 miles or 400, depending on your spot in the South China Sea, a mass force across the ocean that they don't have all the ships for. Now, someone could say, yes, they're building 12 amphibious, and I think that this is important, and maybe we can talk through a little bit later in the conversation. But wait a sec, stop. Why are we making these guys 10 feet tall? Why don't we figure out how to, and this goes to when we wrapped up last time and we talked about, you know, if you're thinking about nothing, you know, over the next week, think about Clausewitz's six primary factors for strategic success. And if you have the advantage of terrain, in the first island chain, and the allies, and the moral, and this is Boydian, this is the moral support,
right?
We're not doing anything wrong. And then this is what's crazy about this whole thing. What is our IO campaign? Really simple. We want the rules-based order to stay as such. We want to protect our friends from bullies. That is our job. From our forward, we are going to project power every day from those positions because our forefathers gave them to us. We don't need to project it from California. And so if you are the adversary and you want to overwhelm us, you're going to need to somehow figure out how to move across 500 miles. And if we get our sensor network right, which we kind of in many ways already have,
right,
or commercially we'd know,
right,
then these are no, we would know. You would shape all of these actions through all of the advantages that we have.
Right.
So some of the criticism, I think last time, you know, some, and guys I respect, I loved it. Scott, you're asking for Corregidor. So these smaller units that are distributed in the key maritime terrain is the big idea. You're asking for Corregidor. And, you know, and again, I'm all about, and the co-author team is all about criticism, but let's unpack that statement.
No, who's building Corregidor, right? I mean, so, right? And so drill down on that. I mean, what you're looking for in terms of sustaining this mobile force is sustainment that isn't Corregidor, but is what?
So let's run backwards and then let's dive into that.
All right.
And so we talk Corregidor and what happened on Bataan. Most of the listeners probably know that we allowed the Japanese to land up to three divisions of their best troops. They had to reroute one from Southeast Asia. We and our Filipino allies allowed them to land. And let's pause and think about that for a sec. And then this force that was isolated, no support, General MacArthur left, fought for over 2 months before they were ultimately defeated. And of course, none of us ever want to be defeated. That then led to this. But the point being, what if you don't let them land in the first place? What if you can see them?
What if they can't land? What if they can't land because we have the same assets that they have? What if they have the exact same problem-solving issues that we have, right?
Yes.
Right.
So this is turn the map around. I mean, this is all second lieutenants.
Right.
Turn the map around and say, we have the advantage of terrain. We have the advantage of popular support, you know, down the line. And so that's part one of the big idea. And then part two is it's not alone. Like we like to think, and we spoke about this briefly last time, MAGTAF, 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 what's the answer? MAGTAF, what's the problem? Don't care. MAGTAF is the answer. What size MAGTAF? It's a MU or a MAF or the SQ, that's it. MAGTAF, MAGTAF, MAGTAF. What are you doing? MAGTAF. Oh, stop. Oh, hold. Hold on. If we lead the world in information technology, which we still do, then let's figure out how to make available to these distributed amphibious close combat units when they need it. Not every second of every day. If they want it every second, let's figure out how to defend networks of this, that. But let's consider these units as part of the entire national architecture. So we have the world's largest economy. Doomsday Guy says, the Chinese economy, worst case scenario, is bigger than the U.S. in 2028. Okay, rockstar. The U.S. plus all of our allies still will have a much larger economy than the Chinese would. So let's say China, if you try to make Corregidor happen on this unit, then we and all of our allies, because we've done such a good job keeping our alliance architecture together, are going to shut down straits, put sanctions on, whatever it is. That's one part of it. The INF treaty dynamic. Imagine if in the not-too-distant future we have theater-range, long-range fires that these small units can call in every single day from all directions. Wow, what would that do to their survivability? And before, maybe they don't even have to call them in because the sensor network sees the threat coming beforehand. What are these? And so some have said the Corregidor piece, and some have said the forces that would come from the blunt layer, we don't know what you mean, they would be overwhelmed. And so we talk about having still, we're not saying get rid of all the big amphib ships. We would still have, and we recommended as part of the big idea to reduce them to somewhere around 25, which has caused a couple of polite butt chewings. And the reason we did that,
you can't do that. Don't you understand? Well, right. Don't you understand? You're playing right into their hands.
Right. I can imagine.
And we said, hey, why don't we? So the primary reason that we did that, for any listener who wasn't listening last week, is the United States Navy has lost 60,000 human beings since 2000. So the number, depending on ebb and flow, somewhere between 58,000 and 60,000 since 2000. So when someone says, Navy, give me another LHA-6, what you've really said, what the Navy's hearing, is give me another 1,000 sailors to operate that ship on a daily basis, and then multiply that times those that need to be recruited and trained in the pipeline. So really, it's give me 3,000 sailors when we've lost 60,000. So let's figure out solutions to this and say, do you need a big ship that has 1,000 sailors with a large marine footprint in order to execute a nationwide, coalition-wide deterrence by denial strategy? And we think the answer to that question is no. Now, that some would balk at that and say, can't give up our position. You know, Cuomo and the team are dumb. They don't understand how politics works and the shipbuilding lobby works and blah, 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 blah. And our counter to that, if counter is even the right word, is we need to have a – this is a democracy. We need to have a conversation with America and lay out even if you get – and by that, our elected representatives, the people who do the shipbuilding lobby, all the places where the ships are built, and saying, hey, here's the deal. 38 amphibs, traditional L-class that come in 2033 do not enable us to do our job. Fact. It just is. We need – like 138 amphibs. And they need to look a little bit different. And because the number one expense in the DOD are the humans, as that goes forward, they become more expensive. We're going to need to figure out how to make more sailors available to go through recruiting, to man these ships, so on and so forth. So, but the point, we're not saying get rid of all the big deck amphibs. We're saying let's stay with about the number that we have now. Let's come off of insisting to get a new one, one every 3 or 4 years, and let's take that structure and dedicate it to a more persistent littoral mission. And so the big idea combines these distributed forces that are part of an entire national architecture, and you mentioned Russia earlier and what's Putin's I.O. campaign,
right.
And the reality of this is we are in the second nuclear age. Our country has 6,800 nuclear weapons to prevent Corregidor. So if we say, okay, wait, we've got nuclear weapons, 6,800 of them. We've got persistent long-range global strike. We have the world's biggest economy. We have all of these. And then let's say, how does the Marine Corps fit into this to enable a national strategy? That is very different than saying, we have no nuclear weapons. We have no global strike. We don't have the world's strongest economy. We have no allies. And if you start with none of those and then you put these distributed units out, then I think it's the face shot is okay. You guys are asking for Corregidor. But if we figure out how to integrate all elements of national power with these units and the sensor network and da-da-da-da, I think it's a very different discussion. So that, in a nutshell, is the big idea. And from here, Mac, I'm assuming you saw the Microsoft rejection, the employees signing that they didn't want to do the hollow. You know what I'm talking about?
Right. Yes. Going down the road of Google, if you will, in terms of employees being upset working with the DOD and whatnot.
Yes. So this is going to kind of get into part 3 and 4 together. So in the article, there's a figure 3.
Okay, hold on. Let me read you an email. We have 25 minutes left, all right? Here's an email. Mac, absolutely riveting stuff, and I think extremely exciting. I think what people need to be welded to is the spirit, the intellectual rigor, and the ghost of General Lejeune and Major Ellis, and not the actual things that they created. Be faithful to the intellectual rigor that has always made the Marine Corps an innovative place, and don't be welded to the things that have come down that support those ideas and that intellectual construct. I hope that makes sense, right, for all the crayon eaters out there. My question is this. Do our traditional battalions and regiments, does that construct support what Major Cuomo, he's a lieutenant colonel, is offering today? Or will the Marine Corps need to look at its core organization and possibly tweak that as well? Cuomo?
So, Mac, thank you, and whomever sent in the question, I could not agree more with be faithful to the intellectual rigor. And that's in it. understand why they did what they did. And this goes to Boyd 101 and the OODA loop, and more importantly, the real way the OODA loop is explained and the orientation. Understand all the impact and why they did what they did. Right. Not this is the only answer, and they obviously expended an incredible amount of intellectual energy. So,
well, you know, the answer. If you read Marine Corps history about these things, these innovations, the Marine Corps wasn't welded to anything. They were welded to what works, what's relative, and what's relevant, and what works. And that's what they were about. And so when you get in the process of defending your terrain that no longer is significant, then to me, you got to go back and do a little reading, and then you got to do a little soul searching, and then you got to come back and say, okay, where are we? And so to me, if you do read Marine Corps history, it was an incredibly vibrant and intellectually pregnant place because it had to be, because people wanted to make them go away all the time, and so they had to find ways to be relevant. Okay, this is our history. This is our orphaned history, right? And we continue down that road, and this is just another chapter in it. So it's very interesting.
Bingo.
Very interesting.
Bingo. In the second part of the question on the battalions and regiments,
yes.
If we can hold off until the recommendation, so give me about 3 minutes, and I think I'll answer that. Is that okay?
Yeah, absolutely. Go ahead.
Okay, so I want to hone in on figure three, and I think it'll answer that the latter part of that question, too. So Microsoft, Google spazzed about elements of Google about Project Maven. So Olivia, Captain Gerard, just did a phenomenal job in highlighting the fiber realities of the world. So figure three, you know, I'm the dumb guy that didn't know this. Olivia brought it to my attention. So when we talk, when anyone on this listening right now talks overseas, some may think it goes through a satellite. Some may have no idea how it gets there. So when I send an email, when I'm talking on, when I do anything, and the reality of it is in figure three, over 99% of international traffic goes through fiber lines under the ocean that go primarily through the strategic choke points. And why does this matter from the big idea and how we communicate it? Figure three lays out that Google, Microsoft, and Facebook have spent billions of dollars to spread Google's mission, to spread ideas and allow people to say and think whatever the hell they want to through their cables. Microsoft protesting, but you look at the graphic and you say, wait a sec. So we think a better argument to work with these companies is to be more, a better way to approach this is to be more clear. Instead of the Marine Corps saying things like, we do large scale missions at mass, we do assault. If we change it, it's not cheesy. What do? For our nation, we're participating in we are a key element in a deterrence by denial strategy to protect the rules-based order. And what does that mean to you, Microsoft? It means that your cables through the South China Sea, or pick your spot in the world, but in this case, through the South China Sea, are currently under threat by these islands that were built, this bullying, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Do you not want your cables protected for the next, your investment for the next 5 to 10 years to make sure that no one can impede them in your profit margin? The answer to that question is probably yes. Okay. The American military and the United States Naval Service does that for you, and they need your help to do it even better. Rad, thumbs up. That's a much better position than leaving it vague or saying, hey, can you build me some type of system using AI or some type of autonomous thing to go do an invasion of a country that we don't have a story on the back end? And they say, where are you invading? Why are you invading it? We're not invading anywhere. We're defending the rules-based order. And if anyone threatens that order through 1984-esque trying to dominate, you can highlight what's going on in Xinjiang and all that. We would only use the stuff or... I mean, this is, we're going to have to figure this out as a democracy. People balk at, we would only use it then. Don't ever say that, some people say. So we're going to have to figure out what's the right way for these companies to say to their employee base, because some of them say, well, Microsoft is not an American. It's an American company, but it's multinational. It has workers. And I'd say, where are the workers from? Well, from India, from Japan, from Taiwan. Well, guess what we're trying to do? Defend the rules-based order, which includes them. So let's figure out how to, and now someone say, well, some of them are from China. I say, this is the larger, we got to figure that out as a country with respect to, well, Chinese workers don't want to work, well, then go home. Or
change your value structure because we don't like what you're offering. All right. So the big idea in practice. So we'll go through because I think there's only 20 minutes and we'll get to answering the Marines' question. So first and foremost, get in the damn arena. Teddy Roosevelt 101. The article when we talk about there's key maritime terrain and we're not there. Well, we're not there persistently. So Admiral Davidson, there's a quote in the presentation. We touched on it in an article. He made a comment, so much of our basing and rotation has been focused on what's transpiring in Northeast Asia, not just in the last couple of years, but really over the last several decades. This is going to require us to revisit some of the places in which we operate and rotate forces. Absolutely. He told the SASC that on the 12th of February. So first and foremost, just like we learned in Iraq and Afghanistan, get the damn arena, you know, Kukulin 101, be there. So that's big idea in practice. Find, and this is hard, define. Someone said to you, key maritime terrain throughout the world. If you're listening, get a pen and write the top 50 locations in the world that matter to America, that matter to Microsoft, that matter to Google. Figure out what they are, prioritize them, and say to the American people through our elected representatives, we believe our future involves being able to influence these 50, and some might say we don't have the resources. Fine. 10, 12, 20. And really, that's a conversation with America. Do you want us to be able to influence all of these spots, 50 of these spots, 30 of these spots? Let's talk about it. The second slide, and this goes to what we talked about in the article. Admiral Davidson, again, the Indo-PACOM commander, has laid out the threats because of Chinese long-range missiles that they've developed over the last 20 years. The president has pulled us out of the INF Treaty. And Admiral Davidson's on record saying, for us to have land-based component with intermediate range capability restores maneuver to the force, making the air, maritime, and land component much more viable in any warfare scenario and presents a much greater challenge for adversaries to threaten. So part of the big idea here is stop Marines putting up PowerPoint slides saying Chinese or Russian or whomever's long-range missiles are all these problems for us and we can't do it. Stop. The president has given us – go and get these missiles instead of saying we have artillery that shoots 30 clicks. Either – and this is an interesting – I don't want to dive in just given the time we have. Either the Marine Corps transitions elements of its artillery community or some components of our Corps – and this will get to have these longer-range fires. And then some would say they cost too much. We don't pay for it. And I say to that, okay, if we don't want to do it, someone in the joint force do it. And then someone says, well, what happens if they take – our boots on the ground spots in country X. I said, well, I don't give a shit. If you don't want Marine artillery to do it, as an American taxpayer, I want someone to do it. So if you say Marines don't do it because that's just not what we do because of whatever reason you have, then let someone else do it. But the point, two points. One, we need to figure out how to help solve that problem, the long-range fires problem, persistent all weather. And the most important thing is we need to figure out in the future – how do we get that capability connected to these amphibious close combat units when they need it? They can be a sensor for it, and they can call for fire from it. And some people balk at and say, that's fucking nuts. There's no way that you're going to have theater range fires. And then I say to that individual, and our co-author team says, and I think we spoke about this last time, if someone were to tell you in 2001 that in 2014, 15, 16, 17, 18, into 19, that remotely piloted aircraft flown from 7,000 miles away have repeatedly and consistently found, killed, tracked, BDA'd more of our nation's enemy year in and year out than the entire $12 billion Marine ace, you wouldn't have believed it. Well, it's true. So why would we not think that persistent all-weather fires of theater range would be so bad? So that's part of the big idea. I won't go through the whole thing, but the article lays out kind of a TDG scenario. And there's a phrase that's part of the kind of the NDS verbiage called fait accompli, which some like, don't use that phrase. Essentially, it means we're in a situation now where if Russia or China takes a piece of terrain, the political costs associated with taking it back due to nuclear weapons, due to having persistent space sensors, due to having persistent unmanned aerial vehicle sensors, due to the constant cyber threat, the political costs with taking it back in almost every single situation are too large. So don't put our policymakers in that situation in the first place. So the scenario in the article walks through what if an adversary tried to do this? How could a forward postured and forward partnered force, both in the contact and the blunt layer, immediately stop this from happening. So if it didn't deter it the entire time from the adversary decision maker even contemplating it, and then they started going through the motions to do it, how could we rapidly generate combat power from across a theater within hours, if not minutes, to say, the escalation cost for you to do this, you're not going to win. So we talked through that, you know, for the purposes of time right now. You'll see that in the article, what that could look like and why it's so important. All right. And actually, in that scenario, we talked through, and it's focused on the Strait of Malacca because it's 21st century, 2019 and beyond, fold the gap. And it's focused on fiber lines because these are all the things that make the world economy work. Oil, fiber, so on and so forth. The next part of the big idea talks about, because some said, hey, you guys are focused on Indo-PACOM and Indo-PACOM only. And we said, that's not necessarily true. We're focused on that region because that's what we were told to do, you know, given the SecDef saying China, 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 the national security strategy, so on and so forth. But as we talk about in the article, the Chinese are extending, as are the Russians in some cases. The Chinese are obviously, they created their first overseas base in Djibouti. So the Marines saying, hey, we don't have the capacity to be in vicinity of the Bab el-Mandeb Strait is probably the wrong answer. It is the wrong answer. We need to figure out how to have more affordable solutions so that we can compete and reassure partners in that part of the world. We don't have treaty allies there. And then we hone in on the Strait, the Bering Strait and the Northern Marine Senator Sullivan. If anyone's, listens to his comments on SAS hearings over and over and over and over and over, he emphasizes the Arctic trade routes increasingly throughout the 20s, throughout the 2020 time period. We show the graphic in the article, but this is of increasing importance. The resources there, there's more American coastline around Alaska and obviously our Canadian ally. Where is the naval force in this region? And it's more than just basing people in Alaska. It's we need to be able to distribute forces and be on the sea, et cetera.
All right. So the same premise that gets you to the South China Sea, gets you around the world to these other critical naval choke points that choke trade and communication.
Bingo, yes. And this is a great opportunity to have a conversation. Like, you could not have this conversation. So if Marines have this conversation with the Senate Orange Service Committee, I mean, I could be wrong. I don't think our co-author, I think you would say, based on any number of intel reports, I think the Senate Armed Service Committee or the Senate Foreign Relations Committee or whatever it would say, yes, these trade routes are going to be increasingly important to our economy. Do you think we should have it? And then I think the answer would be yes. So we are going to adapt what we do in order to make sure that you're, oh, that sounds like a splendid idea. Thank you. I mean, I'm simplifying it, but you know what I'm saying. So we've got 10 minutes. So I'll blast through the Big Eight, and it'll get at the question. So the Big Eight recommendations, number one, embrace expanding the competitive space. The as-is paradigm, or generally larger formations, limited capacity, limited places in the world. The to-be goal paradigm is distributing forces, taking advantage of how technology has changed, but more importantly, taking advantage of one of our quote-unquote asymmetric advantages, and that is the education systems that America has relative to our great power competitors. For example, high school in China is not free. 76% of the Chinese workforce doesn't have a high school degree. So let's take advantage of putting smaller distributed units throughout the contact layer and say, Marines, execute the spirit of MCDP-1. Clearly, we want them connected when necessary, but let's give them commander's intent. Let's make sure that these guys understand, that these guys and gals, that they understand why this matters to our country. Let them go. And every one of us on this net has smiled, if not cried, in awe of beautiful things that young Marines have. So let them roll. This is one of our advantages. We don't need these big formations to do this. All right, that's point one. Point two reinforces this, and you see there's a graphic in the article that lays out what my buddy Dave Blair called the chaos imperative. And the graphic quickly walks through a controlling authoritarian society from birth. What does that do when you are in a controlled society to one's creativity, to one's ability to demonstrate initiative, versus what happens on our own society. And when you look at that over an 18 or 20 year period, the way Dave laid it out in the graphics, we think we have immense trade space opportunity. If we had to battle a great power adversary's distributed units versus ours, we'd take that bet any day of the week and twice on Sunday. So that's rule number two, or, you know, takeaway number two. Literally, seriously embrace maneuver warfare. Reinvigorate it. Embrace calibrated chaos. Point three is update our service concepts. So we got to start from the national security strategy. What is it saying and why is it saying it? And then work through the national defense strategy, through the national military strategy, and then down through what the Navy needs to do. And some listeners might be mad or might say, yep, that's true. We have said too often, our co-author team believes, these are the things that we are programmed to buy or that we have started to buy. So let's build a concept around the program or the platform rather than saying, what does America need us to do in the world that exists? And let's adapt. Let's take, be faithful to the intellectual rigor of Major Ellis and Major General Ajourn. And let's just adapt ourselves. Let's use that rigor and say, this is what America needs us to do, what the Marine Corps does better, and this Bordian fast transient thing. We can adapt our organization to do what America needs. That's point three. But make sure they're in lockstep with the Navy, with the Secretary of the Navy. The signatures are on there. All hands in together. We agree that this is the best way forward. Point four, and this will get specifically to the question. Focus force design on supporting essential naval tasks. And we mentioned the Chief of Naval Operations recently published a design for maintaining maritime superiority. Doesn't end General Gray and General Flynn. We mentioned it in the article. In 2015, created a document called Naval Maneuver Warfare, Linking Sea Control and Power Projection. And that's for, focus the force design. So a future infantry, and this is if the Marine that asked the question wasn't listening last time, I don't care if you call it, and the co-author team certainly doesn't call it an infantry squad if you want, but you had better be able to say that squad is going to have, for example, small UAS capabilities that have a loitering, that have ammunition on them, and they can kill an adversary that's trying to adversely impact the rules-based order out at 6 miles, at 12 miles, or longer. And if the enemy jams the freaks, these things can operate autonomously. If the person that's listening to that says, I'm cool, I can envision that. I can envision a future infantry unit doing that. Then our co-author team says, high five, rad, let's call the future infantry that does that. If you say, instead, the infantry only does locate, close, or destroy at 800 yards and in, and whatever the hell you just talked about, that's something else, then don't call it an infantry squad anymore. Call it whatever helps your brain say, I can imagine the Marine Corps' base small units doing that, whatever that is. And so as this relates to a battalion or a regiment, a battalion today with 81 mortars, 5,700, you know, some 57, 35, 36, depending on the DOTIC and what it looks like, there is no reason why an infantry battalion max effective range today should be 5.7 clicks. Organic. No reason. ISIS is well beyond that. So
okay, let me ask you a grunt question. Okay, I'll sign up for what you're selling right here. Okay, so how does my squad, right? If you want me not only to be able to reach out and see at 6 clicks, but kill at 6 clicks, logistically, how am I configured? Does that come off my seagoing platform? The ordnance come off that? Is that what does it? How does this construct work?
Okay, no, great question. So if the commandant's listening, get yelled at, this gets into the size of this unit. So there's a Gazette article that 3-5 wrote. It's called something like Sea Dragon 2025. Right. I think it would be helpful if you link this to this thread for listeners. And they recommended turning the quote-unquote squad into 15 Marines. Why? And important, they did not say 15 0311s. Important, they did not say 15 0311s. They walk through. We need, of those 15 Marines, there's a joint certified fires expert. There is dedicated digital communications experts. There are dedicated counter UAS experts. And I can't remember. I don't have them in front of me. These are new MOSs. They start with O3 because these individuals want to be in a close combat-like organization. They like doing hand-to-hand fighting. They like being in the cold. They like getting rained on. That's a fundamental first criteria. But because of the logistics concerns, if these guys are going to rock this stuff into the South China Sea and they're going to go up in the mountainous terrain, if you want to call it mountainous, in the Luzon Strait, or they're going to go into Palawan, you can't just say, I'm going to make the squad the same size or smaller and just give it more crap and more things to do and ruck around. Just anyone who's done that knows that doesn't work. So you would have to, the greater logistics throughput would be on these small boats. Some we spoke about, it could be instead of us insisting that the L-class ship carries amphibious assault vehicles, they would have small boats that move around and it could serve as a quote-unquote mothership. But ideally, over time, we take advantage of Clausewitz number one on advantage of terrain, and we would have this stuff distributed with our allies. Small footprint, and say, hey guys, all we're doing is defending the rules-based order. And right now people balk at that. And they said, well, this country's not going to, and we need to have a conversation as America saying, this threat to you exists and it exists to us. So let's partner together and imagine if there's former TBS instructors on the net. Imagine having Filipino Marines or Thai Marines coming through the basic school and saying, this is what it looks like. And the exercise is focused on denying adversaries gaining and from the jump and say, hey, this is how we're doing this overseas to make sure so we have greater logistics supplies. We're going to do this stuff all together. Very different than saying we need to bring all of our stuff from 7,000 miles away. Now, that being said, there's a great video on the Marine Corps website from yesterday of 2nd Battalion, 7th Marines, 3D printing parts to Humvees. And you can, as of 5 years ago, you can 3D print munitions. So this is in our mind, you would still have these capabilities would be forward deployed and you could 3D print most of your stuff. And people are like, nah, that's impossible. Well, ISIS has done a lot of this already.
Right.
So if we think about this differently, I think it answers a lot of these logistical, but it goes to the Marines' question on what does an infantry battalion look like? And some have said, I've gotten yelled at for it, and I think it's a good, healthy discourse. I don't believe that the squad, and I'm doing the quotes here, the squad should be the start point that we're looking at for structure, quote-unquote, savings. I think we should say, and our co-author team thinks we should say, where are all the key? Let's start with what is the national strategy? How does the Marine Corps enable it? What is all the key maritime terrain? Not just on the terrain, the littoral regions, the partner. How many do we need to be at? What would the base unit look like that we would want? Define that. What would be the few? What do they all need to have? They would all need to have counter UAS. They should all have loitering munitions. They all should be able to kick the living shit out of someone with their bare hands if they had to. Worst case scenario, they all need to be able to call in fires from all sorts of directions. Build as many of those as you can, and then say, does the battalion headquarters need to have all these people? Does the regimental headquarters? But right now, and I don't know, I can get yelled at for this.
Hey, get over getting yelled at. He's not a yeller, he's a growler.
It's all good. So that, and I think the logistics is important, but I think oftentimes we think about logistics in a larger assault and it needs to come from a long way away rather than saying, wait, hold on.
It's right here.
The Philippines is, all right, I think I've got 5 minutes. I don't know, I'm looking at the clock. Uh-oh, we don't have any minutes.
Now you got. I'll give you. You have 4 minutes to wrap it up.
All right, 4 minutes and three. So number five, redesign the amphibious component of the 30-year shipbuilding plan. Bottom line for readers or listeners, if you don't know, 30-year shipbuilding plan brings the Marine Corps to 38 traditional amphibs in 2033, 14 years from now. 14 years too late. We describe anything that's not a traditional L-class amphib as an alternate platform. None of us on this net right now ever wanted to be on the JV team, the freshman team, or the B team. These other ships are not alternative platforms. They are critical, essential components to executing the national defense strategy. So call them an amphibious platform. It's just a different size. We call them amphibious fast attack combatant. But the point, 38 doesn't do it. And then if we're going to get more ships, the Navy's lost 60,000 people. So we need to entertain that type of discussion. And then in the article and then in the brief that we spoke about, we can use autonomous ships with this. We can pair manned-unmanned teaming to do this, and we talk about this later. An unmanned vessel that you could put all sorts of missiles and all the logistical concerns that people have raised, the Sea Hunter, if you haven't seen it, the Sea Hunter autonomous vessel left California, sailed to Hawaii, and turned around 5,200 miles on its own with no one helping. That's the technology we've got now. Point number six, fully implement the Close Combat Lethality Task Force guidance. So there's links in the article, or excuse me, in the end notes. And for those, probably many have read the Leavenworth paper from the Dynamics of Doctrine, the change in the German tactical doctrine that laid out how we got stormtroop tactics.
Right.
Like, we need to think about these tactical units that Willie Rohr created. They had operational and strategic impacts almost all the way to Paris until the Marines showed up in 1918. So how do we create future small units, call them what you want, we call them amphibious close combat units, that enable having strategic effects? We think that this can happen. The Close Combat Task Force right now is honed in like a laser on fixing cohesion and manpower to get the quote-unquote strategic sergeant in the unit, cohesive unit. We've got to embrace that, and this slide shows connecting it to cyber capabilities and to long-range fires capabilities. This gets at all the survivability concerns. We talk about the number seven was this relationship that we have growing with SOCOM. Some Marines are like, no, I think we should be good. Fact of the matter is SOCOM has done some phenomenal things since Goldwater Nichols. We need to embrace this and make sure that throughout the contact layer, these two organizations can work together, not compete with each other. We've got to figure out that. That's seven. And then lastly, we emphasize, prioritize, I mentioned part of it, man-to-man teaming. And we've got to, so if the reader or listeners don't know, a Reaper aircraft flew a couple of months ago from North Dakota to England. So almost 4,000 miles, got there and had 18 hours of loiter time remaining. Just unpack that versus what we're saying. And if we're at forward advantage with the terrain, we can have aircraft like this sensing for us. And if someone says, well, the enemy's going to shoot it down. And then think about that from a deterrence by denial perspective. The adversary decided to shoot down sovereign American territory. Think of all the other advantages that we have. And that's just bigger platforms on this, and we talk about in the article, there's no reasons why these small units should not have swarming capabilities. If you were not listening last week, or if you haven't listened yet, in 2017, ISIS, and I'm going to send you the link when we wrap up, ISIS employed a bare minimum of 208 loitering munitions. So if we cannot figure that out, we got some issues, and I know we can. And Marines have already started to. So if we prioritize man-to-man teaming, those are the eight recommendations. And then going back to the Marines' question, does that mean we need to change the infantry TO and T? And I think the answer to those questions is yes. I don't care. Again, co-author team don't care if we still call them infantry, but they're going to need new equipment. They're going to need new certifications. And that 3.5 article, for example, their recommendation is 500 feet and below. You need to say these close combat units, nothing goes in there unless you're calling to them, because those units are employing a bunch of smaller loitering stuff, and they're going to be employing that in great capacity. So we should not constrain those small units from employing it, because we have traditionally manned aircraft. Just prioritize the smaller stuff, and that's the democratization of air power piece. And so those are the eight things. Bottom line, we believe that our Corps got an incredibly, incredibly bright future and an enormous opportunity before it. We just got to make a couple of tweaks. Marines are busting their ass to do it, and an honor to be chatting with you on behalf of the team today.
To me, the most exciting part of all of this is standing on the same real estate as Pete Ellis, right, as General Ajourne, as Heinz Guderian, right? I've got a tractor. I've got a radio. I'm going to go behind, walk behind these infantry guys. I've got an artillery piece that I just put on top of the tractor. What about this? What if we don't need the infantry guys anymore? What if we have so many of these and we just annihilate everything in our path because they cannot stop us? We will flow around them. Don't we then, might we then become a strategic tool, not just a tactical tool? So to me, that kind of intellectual excitement is what you're talking about, Scott.
Well, and you know, some, Mac, I couldn't agree more. Some have responded to this, and I just kind of want to smash my head into a desk. What you guys are saying, we need to become SOCOM. And I kind of smile and laugh, and I say, well, no, because they don't have all these technologies and they're not employed in this construct. But the larger point of having tactical units that didn't exist 33 years ago, having strategic effects for the country, but the reality of it is SOCOM doesn't have enough capacity to do all the things that it needs to do, and the warfare, the character of it's continuing to change, so America needs a greater capacity of this. So we have an enormous opportunity to do exactly what you just said.
Give me the world in which you can get large formations in large ships and get them to the fight and not get them all killed. How does that happen? I don't get that in a peer-to-peer scenario.
Even beyond that, I don't understand in the second nuclear age why a policymaker would ever even say, let's try. I'm agreeing with you.
And we both know they wouldn't. It wouldn't even go there.
So then let's say, and this is the rub, because creating these units that can do this, the Corps, because of the force design on large-scale amphibious assault in Tumab Jafio, would say, I don't have the capacity to put what is today called a JTAC, and we don't think it's just a JTAC because it's long-range fires, it's got to be connected to cyber. So that's what, it's not the current construct. We would say, we don't have the capacity to put this stuff down at that level. And I think we're asking the wrong question. Does the nation need that capacity at that level? The answer to that question, we believe, is yes. So Marine Corps, based on the premise that you just said, show me the scenario where we're taking this giant, you saying you can't do it because you're prioritizing this larger formation. Well, that's not going to happen in the first place.
Well, and to that end, Scott, we talked about this last week, and you brought it up, but we had an opportunity to demonstrate the power of amphibious operations in Desert Storm. We opted not to do it.
We, as a nation, because of, and we hit this in the article, and this isn't because of the mine threat. The primary reason that General Schwarzkopf and our policymakers decided against an amphibious assault was because of the time that it would take to clear the mines and the concern about casualties. Well, now, and this goes to my earlier when I talked about Ian Easton's book, I don't have the reference handy. Now the mines are the problem that you need to get through after you've moved the 2,000 miles through the long-range missile fires.
Exactly.
So it's get comfortable saying, and this goes to what we were talking about with power projection, just project the power forward. You're the good guy. You're already there. Your job is to defend the rules-based order. You can do that and, quote-unquote, complicate the enemy's targeting cycle with your ally. You don't need to do that old, not old in a bad way, General Lejeune and Major Ellis.
Old in a historic way.
Yeah, and say when they were looking at the problem, you could do that. And so that was the answer to the problem.
Right.
Now, be faithful to the intellectual rigor. Appreciate the changing characters of warfare around us, the realities that that has for policymakers, and adapt. And we think we've got a great opportunity to do this. And it's going to be hard. It's going to be hard because of any number of factors, from the organizational culture to how much we've invested in. And I don't want to call programs out here, but I mean, you guys, if you know, you're listening to this, we've got billion-dollar programs that no one was wrong in incurring. But as I think I commented on last time, we think our service needs to say, hey, did anyone predict when X program started in 1992 or 93, when the initial requirement document was written, did anyone think that this country would have 65% of our GDP? And not only that, that they would build these islands and threaten us and legitimately have general officers threatening to shoot anti-ship missiles at our ships?
No, they were going to become part of the world of nations and move and become more democratized. That's what George, that's what the senior Bush sold us. That's why we're doing this.
And so we just need to say, hey, we went off of what our political leaders said. This is a democracy. These were our assumptions. And for better or worse, they just didn't pan out. No one's right. No one's wrong. This is what they... But here's the world that we're in, and unless we change these incredibly expensive and exquisite programs and downstream all the force structure that goes with them, we can't become who you want us to be and what you need us to be. And that's going to be hard.
Yeah, and worst of all, we're playing charades with national defense, and we're not supposed to do that. All right, we may have to do one more segment, Scott, of kind of Q&A stuff, if you don't mind.
Okay.
All right. His name is Scott Cuomo. He's come on and he's been the front person for a series of officers who've written a composite article called Not Yet Openly at War, But Still Mostly at Peace, Exploit the Opportunity to Become the 21st Century Force That Our Nation Needs. Lieutenant Colonel Scott Cuomo, Captain Olivia Gerard, Major Jeff Cummings, and Lieutenant Colonel Noah Spatero. It's in the February. It's on the Gazette website right now. You can go find it there. All right, Cuomo, what I need from you is the Sea Dragon 2025 document that you were discussing, and you were talking about one more article you were going to send me.
I'm going to send you the Twitter or the link to ISIS's 208 attacks in 17.
Got it. All right, and you'll send those to me. I'll put those on the website. I'll shoot you an email. And what I'd like to just do is maybe an hour next week, just a Q&A to follow this thing with different questions that I've had people send to me.
Awesome. Team, damn team. Thank you so much, everyone.
There you have it. Lieutenant Colonel Scott Cuomo here on a Tuesday edition of All Marine Radio. Michael Musselman joins us next. Don't go away.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.